Hey everybody, nice to be here again, and I hope you can hear me. If there's ever a problem with the volume, I see that there is a little icon I can use to raise or lower the volume of my microphone. Oh, okay, loud and clear. That's nice to know. So, as I shared last week, I see this as ideally as a time when you can get your questions answered. That satsang is really about you. And so I'll pause here a little bit at the beginning. I do have something I can talk about if there aren't any burning questions or if no one has a question right away. But if you do, you can either somebody raised their hand. Great, I will let go of the mic. Oops.
Thank you, Nirmala. One of my, I'll say, projects right now is letting go of attachments. And my greatest attachment has been to my wife. And I'm making progress on that, but is there anything you can provide that will help me along on that goal? Thank you.
Yeah, so attachments. One thing to start with, which is I think sometimes a little helpful to remember, is that all of our attachments to your wife, to anything else, all of everyone's attachments, that they're all actually only attached at one end. The attachment is all happening inside of you. I mean, clearly, I'm assuming you don't have a rope or some kind of super glue or something attaching you to your wife all day long. And if you did, you know, she probably would not appreciate it. So this thing, it's this inner thought. It's this inner experience. It's not an actuality. No one has ever figured out how to actually get attached to their money or to their favorite belongings or to their lover or to their spouse. And that's, you know, that's kind of the, yeah, expectations. Ken just typed that it's also expectations that I'm also releasing. And again, the expectations are happening inside of you. You know, if you express them, yes, your wife would be aware of them, but they don't have any actual hold on her, just as the attachments don't have any hold on her actions, on her responses. And so this is, you know, it's both a challenge because it's all happening inside of us. There's not there's not some, again, magical way to hang on to things in life. And it's also a great kind of benefit or relief to discover that they're all happening inside of us. And if they're happening inside of us, that they are really just thoughts. They're really just certain patterns of thought. A good word for it actually is habits. There are certain habits of thought, certain ways of thinking that are habitual. And there are a lot of different things you can do with habits. You mentioned releasing. Sometimes if you just set the intention to let it go. There's a wonderful thing called the Sedona method that is really just a method for actively, consciously choosing to let things go. It's a little more involved than that, and it's got many different approaches, but that's what it really boils down to, is you just say, okay, I'm going to let this go. And, or could you let this go? Actually, they do it kind of tricky. They do it in the form of a question so that if you ask someone, could you let it go? You know, the answer is pretty, a lot easier to say yes to that. Because of course you could. It's not even saying that you will or you have to, it's just saying, could you? And so you say yes. So it introduces this idea of just letting it go. So sometimes with a habit, you can just take that simple step, just step into a place when you notice it arising, just step into a place where you've let go of the habit, or let go of the thought, let go of the expectation. Another kind of tricky way to release a thought like that, an attachment, a desire, anything of that nature, expectation, is to actually just let it be here. Let go of any expectation that the expectations should be gone. You know, if you accept your lack of acceptance, then you are, in a sense, stepping into a place of acceptance. And if you in this moment you are not accepting something, if in this moment you have some really strong expectations, then that is what's appearing, that's what's happening in your body mind. And so this tricky thing is to just turn and accept that it's kind of too late to let go of your expectations in the moment when they're actually present. And that's like, you know, trying to put out a fire before you light it. It doesn't really work. And so you can just accept, allow your lack of acceptance. Accept, allow your attachment. And like I say, when you do that, you create a kind of momentum, a beginning of the experience of acceptance. And then surprisingly, when you're already accepting, when you're accepting that you really don't like what that other person's doing, or you want it, yeah, you accept and allow. When you accept and allow that you, again, starting with yourself, if you accept and allow that you are not accepting, you start with what you can accept in that moment. And I would even suggest that if you're not accepting something, you're accepting that you're not accepting it. It's like, it's like too late to not be accepting that. And so, the acceptance is here already, allowing yourself to have expectations. And so if you consciously acknowledge that you have expectations, if you consciously acknowledge that something is here allowing you to have expectations, then you have, in a sense, begun to experience allowing. You've begun to experience actual acceptance of yourself, in this case. From there, it's an easy step. It's a much smaller step to allowing the other person to be the way they are, to do the thing that you find so difficult to accept. Because you're already in acceptance, and so then it's like there's some momentum. You can just include whatever they're doing. So, and that whole process of first accepting your non-acceptance, your own non-acceptance, because again, that's where it's all happening. It's not actually happening in the other person. When you first accept your own non-acceptance, and then from there move into a place of accepting the other person, what that really, that whole movement, what that also is a new habit. The old habit is to, focus on what you want her to do, what you don't like, what your expectations are, what your attachments are to how she should or shouldn't be. And often the best way to deal with any habit, which is just a thought or a behavior that has some momentum, the best way to deal with it is to just create a completely new habit. Because when you create a completely new habit, you're not going to battle with anything that's already present. You know, it's like that classic thing where you tell someone to not think of a pink elephant. And That's impossible, because as soon as you say that, they think of a pink elephant and then they go to battle with their own thought, trying to get rid of that thought or not think that thought. But in order to not think the thought, they have to imagine a pink elephant and then put a red circle with a line through it to get rid of it or something. And so that's what happens when we go to battle or try to change or fix or an old habit. But when you create a new habit, there's nothing already there to fight with. You create this new habit. I remember once that when I first encountered this concept, just as a way to practice this idea that how easy it is to create a new habit, the person suggested that I first notice how I currently, the sequence that I currently follow when I am taking a shower. And at that time, I used to wash my body first and then shampoo my hair afterwards. And they said, okay, just, don't make that wrong or bad. Don't try and fix or change that habit, but just create a new habit. So the very next time I took a shower, I shampooed my hair first and then washed my body afterwards. And what was so striking, what was so remarkable about that whole experience was that that was like 30 years ago. And to this day, I still now shampoo my hair first and then wash my body. So in a single experience, I was able to create a new habit. So that for the first half of my life, I did things one way. And for the second half of my life, I've done them another way. And so I still have a little bit of hair. Not as much as I did when I changed my habit. And so, the invitation is to create this new habit, but to create it on something where you don't already have a habit you're trying to change. So just accept your non-acceptance. You probably don't have a habit of, and by the way, if you do have a habit of judging yourself for being not accepting, no problem. Just make a new habit of accepting your judgments of yourself. you just kind of pick up wherever it is, wherever you are, wherever it's happening right now. If there's non-acceptance of your wife, you accept that. If there's non-acceptance of yourself for not accepting her, then you can also accept that. So I hope that's helpful. It's a nice, simple, create a new habit rather than change an existing habit. It's a simple, it's like the lazy man's way, the easy way. So I see someone typed in a question. And he said that he or she, I'm not sure, says, I understand a lot about the concept of awakening, but I still suffer. Why doesn't understanding awakening translate into the end of suffering? Oh, my name is Dolores. Sorry, I didn't see that was at the end. So there's understanding of awakening, and then there's the end of suffering. And I would suggest that understanding awakening is, in a sense, the beginning of awakening. It's the first taste, the first kind of quality to the first, glimpse of the experience of a greater knowing of your true self is when you understand it conceptually. It's like some people get it first experientially, but I would say probably most people get it first conceptually. And so that understanding is a wonderful thing, and my guess is that if you really were honest about it, it probably does affect the level of your suffering, especially when you're really immersed in your understanding of awakening, in your understanding of the truth of your true nature. And so conceptual understanding starts to loosen, at least loosen the suffering. Now here's the thing. Suffering and the end of suffering especially, but suffering, the whole movement between suffering and the end of suffering, and the movement from, an over-identification with our body, with our mind, to a more awakened state. They're not separate. They're not like they're all happening within this one awareness, but you can also distinguish them. They aren't really the same thing. And so there can be a lot of movement in terms of awakening without much movement in terms of the end of suffering. And then surprisingly, there can actually be a lot of movement in the experience of suffering, a lot of shift in, to a place of much less suffering that isn't actually related to, to directly to a change in someone's understanding of their, of who and what they are, which is, kind of a working definition we can use right now for the term awakening. I define awakening as a sudden expansion of awareness. And so with that, there can be this big expansion of awareness, but as we were just talking about habits, there can still be a habit of suffering. It doesn't necessarily undo that habit. And what's fascinating is how the whole experience of awakening, the beginning experiences of awakening, can actually be fuel for more suffering, especially if it's kind of coming and going. Because then the coming and going of the sense of awakening is something you now suffer over. And so what is suffering? Suffering is, it's surprisingly simple, really. Suffering is, again, that it's like attachment. In fact, some people define suffering as attachment. It's this movement within you to either hang on to or resist what's happening. And so, because what's happening is always changing, hanging on to it tends to cause suffering. And because what's happening is always happening, resisting it is an experience of suffering. It's that tension, that inner grasping or resisting, that inner struggle or striving against what is, that's suffering. And there's a huge momentum to that. We were taught very early on, conditioned and taught to resist or to grasp. And it's not even, it's, to be fair, to be compassionate towards our tendency to do that, the reason is that every now and then it seems to work. Every now and then you grasp after something, you strive, you struggle, and you get it. Like it was in an Oscar Wilde play, there's a line where one of the characters says, there are two great tragedies in life. One is when you don't get what you want, and the other is when you do. And so, this view of suffering, when you occasionally get what you want, or when you occasionally are able to fix things or change things or get someone to stop doing something or get rid of something in your life that you don't like, some problem, that reinforces this tendency to resist or grasp. And so, every time we are successful at fixing or changing our suffering, it reinforces our suffering. So that's the movement of suffering. Now the other movement, again, is the movement of awakening, the movement of this expansion of awareness. And that awareness can become very expanded, and still there can be this momentum to this tendency to want to hang on, even hang on to that experience, or hang on to other aspects of experience. I said earlier, these are not separate phenomena. They can't help but affect each other. When your awareness gets very expanded, even beyond just understanding, and starts to be kind of experiential, that you are something much bigger and vaster and more unharmable than your body or your mind, then that naturally will affect how much you strive. It can't help but affect it. But here's a way of putting it, it doesn't erase your capacity to suffer. In fact, I don't think I've ever met anyone, and I've had the great pleasure and honor of hanging out with some very, very awake people, including many that are well known as spiritual teachers. And especially if you get to hang out with them outside of satsang, you get to just kind of hang out with them day in, day out, go through some of the, kind of ordinary experiences of life. And it's really obvious that they still have 100% capacity to suffer. They do. They suffer a lot less than probably the average person. But just like if you haven't ridden a bike in 30, 40 years, you can get right back on a bike and start pedaling. You don't have to learn again with training wheels. So even if it's been days or weeks or months since you last had this movement of resistance in you, this reaction of resistance or grasping, it's not the capacity to do that is not gone. So maybe that's one kind of level of an answer to your question, is that to expect there to be no suffering would probably be an unrealistic expectation around any degree of awakening, even a very, very profound awakening. So again, these are two separate processes that affect each other. I'm not sure if what I've shared, kind of got to the heart of your question. As you said, your understanding of awakening isn't enough. And that's probably a valid observation, because that sense of expanded awareness can take in much, much more than just kind of the inner thought processes. In fact, someone on here typed in, "I had it experientially before my mind took over later." And before that, she was living mostly intuitively, like a wild animal. Yeah, so it doesn't always happen with the mind first. It sometimes happens more, you could say, more in the heart or more in the belly. And so you become very instinctual and intuitive. And then the mind, again, you haven't lost the mind. You haven't lost the capacity to think or to use the mind to suffer. So it can creep back in, or under certain contexts. I used to joke that we should do a scientific experiment where we line up a whole bunch of spiritual teachers and then have people in white lab coats go down the line and start poking them pretty hard right in the middle of the chest, and just keep poking and poking and poking and poking until they got angry. And you just have a little clipboard and write down how many pokes each teacher took before they got angry. So again, under the right context, resistance, suffering might still arise. I can share that for me, this is my experience. For me, the various shifts in my awareness, and I think it wasn't just that, I think it was also a deep, deep curiosity about suffering and about my own responses to things. But what has changed over time, again, is not my capacity to suffer. And in some ways, maybe not even my tendency to suffer. Like, it can still, every single day, I can have some kind of grasping or resistant pattern, habit, start to occur. I can get contracted. And what's different is that they don't last very long. They sometimes come and go almost as fast as a sneeze. It's just like this, and then a second later it's like, who cares? It's like that quick. And so, again, I would invite you to get really curious about your own experience. of suffering, and how has it changed? Has it, does it, you know, I remember, you know, it's kind of a vague memory now, but I remember periods of suffering in my life where it just seemed like it was like a full-time job, and I just like would get up and day after day after day the same, and I would just, oh, you know, I was like, and I remember even that back then thinking, oh God, how can I, you know, I know I can stop suffering because it's happened before. I've suddenly felt better, but I can't seem to make it feel better. And then even back then, it would just like shift. Sometimes for no clear or obvious reason, because I think that much of what we call cause and effect are things that we're not always consciously aware of what the cause is and what the effect is. But now that shift happens more quickly. So I would invite you to, instead of comparing yourself to your image of what it's like for someone out there who you think doesn't suffer anymore, I would compare yourself today, in general, you know, overall in the current general period of time, to yourself a year ago or 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and just notice whether all this understanding that you have accumulated, that you have, you know, probably had genuine experiences of understanding, whether it has lightened or loosened and reduced the amount of time that you spend suffering. Again, comparing yourself to yourself in the past. Any other topics or questions, or anybody else want to even just share something? It doesn't have to be in the form of a question. I always found when I was in satsang, I always like to have a question, because I think there's something powerful about the direct interaction back and forth with a teacher. But what would often happen is that when I got into satsang, someone else would ask my question. They would always raise their hand before me and ask the same question, and I'd be like, oh, well, now I don't have a question. So Ken just typed in, resistance to meditation. Is that a topic you want me to speak about? I assume that's why you typed that. Oh, here's somebody else. Somebody's raising their hand. Okay. Let me go to the person who's raised their hand, and then I'll come back to the question of resistance to meditation. So KJ,
So I'm just walking in the house right now on my Mac. I had a question that just deals with relative life, you know, day in, day out life, just in the sense of there's been resistance within my family about the intensity of or the increase in intensity of my spiritual practice. And I've taken some criticism as a result of that, and it doesn't sway me to do less. And I've tried to be more forthright about that being my priority, that God is my priority, and, you know, to be accommodating in other ways. But I was wondering, and also friends falling away and whatnot. And so I'm wondering if you've had any experiences like that, or if you have any comments on that. So I will give up the mic. Thank you.
Yeah, so Yeah, that's a, I mean, clearly, in a sense, the question is about relationships, and yes, it's specific to the choices you're making and their resistance, their attachments and expectations, and how you're not necessarily meeting them. And so, I'm gonna address it from a very, very broad point of view, because it sounds a little bit like you are, how to say it, you are standing in your truth. You are choosing to still pursue what is important to you. But I find it really helpful to have a kind of understanding of a certain dynamic in any relationship. And in order to keep it simple, we'll really just speak about it in terms of two people relating. Obviously, there's much more complexity when you have three or more, but the principle is still there. It's just simpler to explain it with just two people. And so, very simply, when you have two people interacting, two people in a room together, two people having a conversation, there are, from the perspective of consciousness, there are two possibilities to what's happening in that interaction. One possibility is that both people are like equally expanded or equally contracted. So, like right now, when I say equally expanded, I have both my hands facing each other, wide open, spread apart, my fingers spread apart. Or equally contracted, I'm making two fists. And so, but the point is that they're equal, and anywhere in between, any degree of expansion or contraction of their consciousness, of their understanding, of their awareness, of their state of being. When it's equal like that, it's very comfortable and easy to be together. There's that wonderful saying, misery loves company. And so, if you're in a really bad mood and you're with someone who's in a really bad mood, you kind of get along really well, because you're like mirroring each other. You're resonating. You're at the same kind of level of consciousness, and that's very comfortable. It's like things that when you're with people that are a lot like you, it's comfortable. It's easy. There's no stress. And again, that if you're both really expanded, it's easy to be around each other because you just resonate. You're in the same, a very similar state. Now, the other possibility, which we've all experienced from both sides, is when one person is very expanded, or relatively expanded anyways, and one person is either very contracted or relatively contracted. So now I have one hand, in a fist, and one hand wide open. And so now there's a difference. Now the really fascinating thing about this is that when that difference is present, the person who is more expanded is actually not particularly affected. It's just the nature of expanded awareness. Expanded awareness has more room for everything. Expanded awareness has less resistance, or tends to have less resistance. Like I said, there can still be pockets of resistance or suffering even in very expanded awareness. But just in general, there's more capacity to be with whatever is. And so the person who's more expanded is okay. There's not really that much of a problem. However, for the person who's more contracted, and again, like I said, we've all been on both sides of this. We've all been around some really amazing spiritual master who is way more expanded than us. And we've all been around someone who is way more contracted than us in the moment. But when you're the person that's more contracted, it's actually very uncomfortable to be around that expanded awareness. It's almost like a pressure. It's like, I mean, there's so much, there can be, especially around someone who's very expanded, there can be so much light, so much shining. Aren't you your contraction, onto your experience. And the contrast is so uncomfortable because you're in a place of contraction. You're in a place that, if it persists, gets very uncomfortable. And so, I don't know if you can hear that. My dog is snoring in the corner of the room. So, if you're the more contracted person, hey Rafi, thanks. So, if you're the more contracted person, you're going to feel this pressure. This it's not just your own contraction. You're going to feel this pressure coming from that expanded awareness, and it's kind of uncomfortable. Kathy called it. They say it's bullshit, not light. That's probably true, because the next thing I was going to say is that what mostly happens when a person who's more contracted encounters someone who's more expanded is that they do whatever they know how to do in order to get that person to contract. That's usually the first, right? The first strategy, the first response is do something that you know or that you hope or that you think might get that other person to contract, because then, you know, that relieves the pressure, you're both contracted, everybody's, you know, comfortable again. And so the more contracted person, and like I just want to stress again, we all have found ourselves on both sides of this. The person who's more contracted will either criticize, attack, overly praise, which can sometimes trigger a contraction if someone's overly praising you, if you kind of buy into it, if your ego gets caught on that compliment or praise. It will jump in and push and prod and poke. I used to give a lot of satsangs and with live audiences, and you know, it was kind of fun to watch. People would come up and they would try and get me to contract. You know, it's almost like trying to stump the satsang teacher. You know, try and get them to react, get them angry, do something. You know, anything you could do to get them to contract, then you won't have to feel so bad about being contracted. And so, yeah, you just keep poking that other person. Now, ideally, if you know, the ideal solution really is for the person who's more contracted to use that opportunity to expand. To gain more understanding, to open up, to relax, to let go. And if that's happening, if that is possible, it's a beautiful opportunity for everyone. You know, it's a beautiful thing to be in the presence of that kind of release or opening. And of course, it's especially it's a much more complete relief of the discomfort for the person who's more contracted. And so, from the perspective of the person who's more expanded, that's really, in a sense, you know, you can hold that lightly as your idea of what could or you know, is possible. And so, you can, you know, just hold that possibility as much as you can, not buy into all their attempts to get you upset or contracted or. You know, doubting yourself, whatever means they're going to use. If ultimately, I mean, Kathy mentions that her kids do this, so it may not be realistic, but ultimately, if there's no purpose to being around that person, because they're just going to, especially if every time you hang around with them, they eventually get you to contract, and they're like successful, then you just leave. You know, Kathy mentioned that she has friends that have fallen away. And if every time you're around somebody, they just simply manage to get you to contract, they never take that opportunity to expand. Yeah, you know, I mean, you can be compassionate, you can be giving, but at a certain point, you can let it go. And so that understanding that dynamic Sometimes it can, just understanding it can make it like, oh yeah, they're just trying to, they're just trying to get my goat. They're just trying to tease me or, trigger me because, because they are in pain. They are in discomfort. And like I said, especially if you remember the times you've been on the other side. And it's amazing to watch it because it comes up very unconsciously. You just find yourself teasing the person, something like that. Oh, I see Kathy's raised her hand again, so I'm going to let the mic go. And I haven't forgotten Ken's question.
I just want to first to thank you for addressing this. Your answer has been very helpful. One of the things I noticed for myself in a conflicted situation in which it became, I was believing my emotions. I was believing my emotions. I'm an emotional human being, and one of these personas that's emotional. So I cry very easily, both happily and, in a suffering sort of a way. So, but something that's been very, very helpful to me this week, out of Regina's teaching on emotions was that, our emotions are liars. They obviously stem from our thoughts, but sometimes I don't catch myself. I'm already involved in thought. I'm already involved in whatever the external scene seems to be, and the emotions quickly follow for me. And oftentimes I don't notice that I'm out of awareness until there's a strong emotion going on. And so just that notion that my emotions are not to be believed in as well somehow seemed like a new idea to me, and it was very helpful. But like you just shared prior to this, all of this from me, it doesn't mean that those emotions are going to stop coming just because I had that kind of that aha moment, and also was able to look at it when the initial conflict happened. I wasn't able to be in my higher mind completely at that time. Therefore, I wasn't in my higher mind. Ego was also operating. And I was able to notice it afterwards. I was able to see a habitual reaction and a belief that I was holding about myself, that I would believe this criticism that seemed to be directed my way, would only affect me if I already held that belief within my own mind. And so I was able to use that situation of conflict in a helpful way. And so it didn't seem, quite so bad as just walking away and licking my wounds, so to speak. Yeah, and that's all I wanted to share, but thank you very much for addressing this topic right now. I'll give up the mic.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I use a slightly different language about it all. I say all there is truth. All there is this limitless, infinite, one beingness, perfection that extends throughout all dimensions, all levels, all aspects of reality, including thought and emotion. And feelings are completely normal. Feelings are completely natural. And the distinction you can make is that it's not that they're false. It's not that they're wrong. It's just that they're not very true. Again, this idea of being contracted. Often when there's strong feelings, we're very contracted, and we're only experiencing a limited perspective, a limited degree of truth. And that's not, it's not, again, so you don't have to make the feelings bad or wrong. as we were talking about earlier, acceptance is the best antidote. It's a paradoxical antidote because, you know, it's kind of, I often say that the most profound healing is to realize that nothing here needs to be healed. And so when you realize that it's okay to have your feelings, then they can just be here. You can actually, your awareness can expand to include more than your feelings. So they don't, you know, they don't have to be made wrong or bad in order to release the suffering that they can cause if you're resisting them or trying to get rid of them or change them. So it seems like resistance is a lot the theme. I just want to, before I take another question, if there's time, but I just want to get to Ken's question, which, you know, he just said he wanted me to talk about resistance to meditation. And it's really just like every other kind of resistance. The antidote, again, is to see there's nothing wrong with it, to completely accept that you feel resistance. There's all kinds of things you can do, you know, new habits you can do. One thing is to go ahead and meditate. Make it a new habit to meditate even when you're feeling resistance. That's kind of an interesting one to play with. I guess what I'll say first is that often when I answer questions, I'll answer them at several different levels, and that they are all true. They are all valid and relevant. They just occur, they happen at different levels. So at one level, you can address the resistance to the meditation, where you just accept that there's resistance, and you know, sometimes even just go ahead and do it. It's like a Nike, you know, just do it. You know, just put on your Nikes and sit down and meditate. And so that's, you know, one approach is to just totally accept that you're feeling resistance and still choose to meditate. Another level at which to address that, which is actually a really fascinating one to explore, is that I spoke a little bit about this last week, is that there are many, many different practices, spiritual practices, and different types of meditation, and that in most cases, even the best and the ones that have been around for you know, tens or hundreds of years, these long-term, you know, successful spiritual practices and paths, at best they work for maybe at best 10%, but actually it's probably more like 5 to 6% of the people that encounter them. And so it is also a question of whether the meditation you are doing is the appropriate one for you. And you know, it's a totally valid thing to address that resistance by also exploring different kinds of meditation and finding if there's one that right now just, you know, I mean, ideally you find one that you you're like, oh boy, oh good, I got some time, I'm going to go meditate. You know, the opposite of resistance, you have this desire to meditate. And that same, and this is all, again, this is all on the practical level. It's not on the more profound level where like all of this is perfect and, you know, and then even beyond that, the level at which where nothing, none of this is even happening, you know, which are all equally valid perspectives on any of these questions. The different levels of truth that are all true simultaneously. But another more practical thing to explore with meditation is just some practical suggestions. One is that this is based on very recent neuroscience research, that there's actually something that happens in your brain typically at around 45 minutes in various forms of meditation that kind of takes it to a whole nother level. It's kind of like, I always use the metaphor, it's kind of like you've been riding down the freeway in fourth gear in a 5-speed manual transmission, and then you suddenly remember there's a fifth gear, and you pop it into fifth gear, and it's like, everything, you know, the engine, everything just calms down. And so there's a definite shift that neuroscience has shown happens more typically after about 45 minutes. So if you're currently meditating twice a day for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, the suggestion would be to rearrange your schedule and meditate for an hour. Give yourself a really enough time for that more subtle shift to take effect. And then you might find that, you know, again, that that resistance turns into attraction. That resistance turns into like, oh, I can't wait to meditate because, wow, what a powerful experience it turns out to be when I actually, you know, do it. It's kind of like the motivation that comes after you've been exercising at the gym for a while, and after a while you like feel so good after you've been to the gym that the resistance is not a lot easier to overcome. So that's one suggestion. Another this is just another little practical thing I throw out, which I actually picked up, somebody posted it on Facebook. They suggested that when you meditate, not only that you make your body very still, but that you make your eyes, your physical eyes, very still. I usually do it just by allowing them to kind of, I consciously allow them to sink down in my eye sockets and get very heavy. And that added layer of stillness can also allow meditation to go much deeper, much more quickly. So I don't know, those are very practical questions. Since we've been talking a lot about resistance, I might leave it there. And I also see Christine shared a wonderful story about her experience of being in an expanded state with a contracted friend when she was out in nature with him, and she felt very expanded out in nature and he felt very contracted. Plus he had allergies that could contract you. I know about that one. And so, you know, it's just amazing when we experience this. You know, and again, you know, if you can stay in your expanded state, that ultimately that serves yourself and them the most profoundly, because the contraction really is all within them. Just as I said earlier, when we are experiencing resistance or expectation or attachment, the truth is that's all happening inside of our body mind, inside of our apparent, you know, individuality. And so that you know, that's where you can learn about it. That's where you can become curious and find out what's really going on here. When it's, you know, like I said, there's different levels of truth. So sometimes you can change something in your environment, and it will shift, and then you don't, you know, that's always worth it. There's a great story of some students were sitting around talking to my teacher's teacher. It was a man named Papaji, and they were all sitting around talking, and he read a letter from another student who was having a very difficult time meditating because he lived upstairs from an auto body repair shop. And every time he sat down to meditate, there would be all this clanging and banging and, you know, power tools, and he just, you know, he just found it really difficult to meditate with that much noise. And so Papaji, you know, he was sitting there with all of these other students. He read them the letter, and he said, "Well, what would you tell him?" And he went around the room, and one by one, the students all came up with these beautiful and profound non-dual spiritual answers to the question. You know, they said that he should find out who it is that's bothered by the noise. He should, you know, make the noise into his meditation. You know, he should, practice all the things I've been talking about of accepting, allowing, on and on and on and on. And then when he was done going around the circle of his students, Papaji said, "You know, those are really good answers." And then he said, but I think you guys maybe overlooked the most obvious answer, and that is move. If you can't meditate because you live upstairs from an auto body repair shop, you know, you can always move. And that's another level at which anything in life can be addressed. There is no question that, you know, while we're here, while we're in an apparent body, that level of truth still operates, still functions. In fact, that's what I was going to talk about today, but here we are at the end of the hour. I was going to talk about you can split it up any way you want, and there's all kinds of different maps or models as to the different levels of reality. But, you know, by understanding that there are different levels of reality that are all simultaneously true, then it's okay to address a problem on the pragmatic, practical, physical, non-mystical level. You know, back to you know, the original question about a relationship. You know, sometimes if you just ask, the person you're with will, you know, say, hey, you know, I find it really difficult when you da 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 da, and they say, oh, I didn't know. Okay, sure, you know, no problem. I can do what you want, and it's like, oh, okay. You know, and hopefully when they ask you sometime and it's no big deal, you can accommodate their needs. It's okay to address things on the practical level. And then it's also, of course, profoundly helpful to also be able to shift into an expanded viewpoint where everything is perfect. And then, as I mentioned briefly, you know, beyond that, into a place where none of this is even happening, none of this is real. I'm not so much an expert on the Course in Miracles, but I think it often addresses things from that kind of absolute, ultimate level, if not at least from the more level of divine will and perfection and how everything is fine just the way it is. And speaking of everything being fine just the way it is now 11:30. So I have enjoyed this and look forward to next week. And I'll mention real briefly again that you can ask your questions here in the room, I guess they call it here, or in Paltalk, or you can email me ahead of time. I'll type in the address, and then you know, and then I can you know, consider your question for next week. So I will let go of the mic and talk to you all again next week. Bye now.